Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2023, and this is a milestone episode. It's episode 350, which is a conversation about exorcism films. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Philip Tallon, who is with us all the way back at the beginning 7 years ago for episode number one. Phil is an associate professor of theology at Houston Christian University. He is also the author of The Poetics of Evil. Phil has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it is called The Power of the Devil Compels Us, Possession and Exorcism Movies in a Modern Age. And you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. Phil, it's good to have you on again.
Always good to be here.
Now, two of the films we will be talking about for this episode are The Pope's Exorcist and Nefarious. Now, both of these films originate from Christian sources, and The Pope's Exorcist is loosely based on the writings of a Roman Catholic priest by the name of Father Gabriel Amaroth, and he is the main character of The Pope's Exorcist. Now, Nefarious is an independent Christian film, and it's based on a novel by Steve Deese, and it kind of has an evangelistic purpose to it. And both of these films tell the stories of people who are possessed by a demon, and that situation, that demonic situation, is eventually overcome by the power of God. Now, The Pope's Exorcist stars Russell Crowe as Father Amaroth, and he is a priest dispatched to Spain to look into the case of a boy possessed by a demon in a Spanish abbey. And actually, Father Amaroth is a real person, now deceased, who claimed to have performed many thousands of exorcisms. And then the independent Christian film Nefarious shows an encounter of a psychiatrist, Dr. James Martin, and he's assigned to decide the sanity of a death row prisoner who seems to suffer from multiple personalities. Now, both of these films are recent entries into really a big canon of demon possession films. And I am not a horror film person, so when I watched the trailer for the rated R Pope's Exorcist starring Russell Crowe, I immediately thought, there is no way I'm going to watch this film. So I want to start out by asking you why Christians should even watch an exorcism film. I mean, there are Christians concerned that this glorifies the demonic and this would be unedifying or exposing you to focus on the demonic. So why would any Christian even interact with an exorcism film?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's one that I encounter a lot because I write about horror. I've got a book on horror that I'm working on right now. And people say, why would you spend your time on this? And of course, the good news is that folks don't have to watch these movies. They're not obligatory, and they're not a necessary part of anybody's cinematic education. And so you can avoid them, especially if you're, you know, sensitive or, you know, might lose sleep. But this is most art just kind of is optional for us. And there are other things to watch. But I think one good reason that people do watch horror movies is that we live in a very disenchanted age, right? I think we're, you know, if you talk to most folks, even people in the pews, there's not a strong sense of the spiritual world surrounding us in the way that you might find in the New Testament thought world, where there's, you know, powerful spiritual forces that kind of pervade every aspect of society. And so I think C.S. Lewis in his Screwtape Letters provides a sort of a good, you know, guide here, which is he says there are two opposite errors one can make about devils. You can either ignore them or deny their existence entirely, or you can be unhealthily obsessed with them. And so if you're prone to be unhealthily obsessed with the demonic, then by all means, steer clear. But I think for most of us, we've grown insensitive to the spiritual world. We don't think in terms of spiritual warfare or the reality of and the supernatural, maybe anything besides just God, you know, out there, maybe hearing our prayers. And so we fall into this kind of moralistic therapeutic deism is the kind of the term that's often fallen in place, where basically worlds largely just operate by natural processes and then kind of God gets involved somewhere. But that's not the New Testament view. Jesus's ministry is marked not just by healing and by teaching, but by exorcism. That's one of the things Jesus is known for. If you read through the Gospels, you see Jesus is frequently encountering evil spirits that he then meets in combat. And so I think that exorcism movies can actually help to kind of reorient us toward a biblical reality, which is that there is a spiritual world. And we've fallen into one of the errors that Lewis warns about. And so this is a sort of a shock to the system to bring us back into a New Testament way of viewing things.
Just this spring, I reread the Screwtape Letters because at my church we had a Sunday school class elective about the Screwtape Letters, and I don't think I had read it since middle school. And so it'd been a long time, and I just thought it was so applicable to where we are in the 21st century in 2023. And so I highly recommend anyone to read it. It just gave so much food for thought. And also, I'm just wondering, now that's kind of like, why should Christians? But on the flip side, I want to ask about maybe there's an interest in these kinds of movies by maybe non-Christians in the idea of demons. Now, I mentioned already there was The Pope's Exorcist and Nefarious that came out in the spring, but then also there's another movie going to be released in October called The Exorcist Believer. I'm wondering, is that, just as an aside, is that related to kind of a sequel to The Real Exorcist, or they're just using that title? But why do you think there's an interest in movies about demons, even from, you know, people who aren't religious? Because they're probably going to go see these movies as well.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are a number of reasons. Obviously, first off, I think we're in an age where every possible kind of facet and iteration of entertainment is going to be explored and fully exploited. All the intellectual property that's out there, all that stuff is going into the hopper. And so there are a lot of exorcism movies out there. There's a lot of every kind of movie just about out there right now. But there are, it's hard to even count the number of exorcist movies that have been released recently. And I know people who, you know, really fascinated by them, horror fans. And for a filmmaker, I think it's, you know, easy to see why filmmakers would be drawn to this. It's a nice, easy setup for a horror film. You need a good actor to play the possessed person and just a little bit of effects and some makeup. And also, I think that there's still a real charge that evil spirits have for audiences. So I know a number of critics and other folks who say, you know, I can watch almost any monster movie and they don't bother me, or a slasher movie and it doesn't really get to me. But something about the spiritual really still has that charge. And so for people who consume horror, there still seems to be some potency in the genre. It still works. I think that kind of connects a little bit, you know, back to what I said before, which is that we kind of live in a disenchanted age, but maybe our disenchantment isn't quite as sturdy as we might think, and that there's something about the same way that Christians could be reminded about the spiritual that regular audiences, people who aren't particularly devout, might also still find something in being reminded of the possibility of the spiritual world, even if, you know, done in this dark tone.
Well, first I want to ask you a little bit about the film that I talked about earlier, The Pope's Exorcist, that starred Russell Crowe as a Roman Catholic priest.
first of all, that was kind of more of a medium budget Hollywood movie, and yet it made more than $74 million worldwide. And it's based on the life of a real exorcist. Now, for Protestants, that would surprise us. I guess I didn't know that there were Roman Catholic priests who were specifically, that is their calling, to be an exorcist. So, and it also, from reviews I read, as I mentioned, it had a scary element to it, but also kind of there's a humorous take on it, is what I read in some of the reviews. So you, unlike me, you did go see the film. What did you think of this movie?
It's well, I think it's not up to the caliber of a film like The Exorcist, which it's thinking about and kind of referring to. And I would imagine that if Father Gabriel Amorth, who the film is based on, saw it, he would just be shaking his head most of the time, because it's a much kind of trashier film than his source material would suggest. Is there's a little bit of nudity in it. There's a lot of kind of gore. There's some kind of goofiness, and so audiences take note. But it's definitely an attempt to kind of make this real historical character, Gabriel Amorth, who's appointed by the Vatican as an exorcist. He was an apprentice. He was a psychiatrist and or a psychologist, and then basically kind of wound up stepping into the role of exorcist, participated in many exorcisms, and has written his accounts in multiple books published by Ignatius Press, which is a major Catholic press. And the version of Gabriel Amorth that appears on screen is played by Russell Crowe, who's kind of at the perfect age and stage to play that. He looks like somebody who's got a lot of miles on him. He's someone who is actually really positively portrayed, heroically portrayed. He takes the spiritual seriously, but he's also a joyful and warm person who has to stand up at various points to forces within the Roman Catholic hierarchy that are telling him that exorcism is out of date and the church wants to move beyond this. But he knows that the spiritual is real, and his powers are needed when a young boy in Spain is possessed by this demon that inhabits an old Spanish abbey. And so Father Amorth travels on his Vespa with his cross and his Bible and his flask of whiskey, and heads off to go investigate what's going on. And what we see is, I think, pretty typical exorcism type fare. The boy says, you know, blasphemous things. Regular medicine and psychological treatment are unable to help him, and so the family has to turn to spiritual guidance. And here Father Amorth strides in and helps another young priest to handle this this particular problem. And the whole thing, I think the movie did well enough. It's possible there'll be more. It ends on this note that, like, this is the first of many adventures that we'll watch Father Gabriel Amorth go on as he encounters various demons. So the commendable things about the movie are that I think it is a positive portrayal of a very earthy and relatable priest who has a serious faith, and so it's a, you know, it's positive in that regard. In some sense, the movie is actually comes off a bit like an apologetic for the Roman Catholic Church in some strange ways. For one, it suggests that the Spanish Inquisition was actually just orchestrated by this malevolent demon, kind of maybe excusing the church's, you know, complicity in the Inquisition. But, you know, in other ways, he's still wrestling against, you know, various forms of hierarchy, but he wins out in the end. And you see the Vatican has a kind of spy network almost of researchers and monks, and the Pope is helping out to do some research for Gabriel Amorth. And so it's a like half exorcism movie, half Mission Impossible or something like that. But I know a lot of people really liked it. I watched it with my students this summer, and we talked about it, and they thought it was a much better film than I did, and really, really appreciated the positive portrayal of a priest, which is somewhat, I think, unusual in Hollywood fare.
Wait, don't skip this break, because we've been receiving emails at the Christian Research Institute with people asking us that they are unclear about what is going on with the Christian Research Journal's print edition. Well, you might have missed my recent pod blast called A Fond Farewell But Not a Goodbye, and you can go back in your podcast stream and look for it and listen to that. Or if you prefer to read something, same title, A Fond Farewell But Not a Goodbye, is available on our website, equip.org, in the articles section. If you click on that, and you will see it there. It's an editorial that I wrote about the history of the Christian Research Journal and what we're looking forward to in the future, which is to be with you every week with a new episode of this podcast, Postmodern Realities, as well as supporting articles on our website, equip.org. But then, now more than ever, we need your support. You won't be subscribing to the Christian Research Journal because all of this great content is free for everyone, but we would really like more people to find out about this podcast and read our articles. And so the best way they can do that is if you give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Just a simple sentence about why you enjoy the content that we have would really help us out and would allow more people to find us. So with that, back to my conversation, this big milestone episode number 350, and I'm talking about exorcism films with Dr. Philip Tallon from Houston Christian University. Well, I think it's interesting that the film about Father Gabriel Amorth ended kind of like, oh, there could be more coming, just because supposedly he performed many thousands of exorcisms. So I guess they can have a lot of different follow-ups to this particular movie. And he is deceased now, but he lived to be quite old, in his 90s. So this is something that the Roman Catholic Church has in that they participate in, because they definitely have specific rites that they do for exorcisms. So it's interesting to see that this is based on some real life stuff that's not normally that we think about in evangelical Protestantism, although there are a lot of deliverance ministries that are part of like maybe more Pentecostal branches of the church.
If people are interested in finding out more, there are books from Ignatius Press by Amorth, and then also William Friedkin, the director of The Exorcist, created a documentary called The Devil and Father Amorth that is about his work. And you can find that. But it is interesting. One of the things that you often notice in exorcism movies is that really the Catholic Church plays prominently. I think partly, you know, there's a lot of kind of ritual and sort of trappings that go with Catholic exorcism, but it's certainly not only the domain of Catholic practice. And so you find other, you know, Protestant denominations, especially I think in the sort of Pentecostal charismatic world, kind of a high awareness of the spiritual role of exorcism. But there are stories of Presbyterian pastors performing exorcisms and many others.
Just out of curiosity, did the director of the Pope's Exorcist, does he have any particular religious leanings because he wanted to make a film about a Roman Catholic priest?
No, the director, Avery, is his name. He does not seem to have any, you know, strong faith and actually is really kind of a genre kind of schlock director in a lot of ways. And so I think if there's, you know, much of the piety that's in the movie probably just comes from the source material. And that's not the case for all exorcism movies we'll talk about. So a lot of the material that goes into these exorcism movies seems to actually originate from a position of faith, though often you have directors that are then kind of interpreting the material. And that can actually be helpful in certain ways to make the film successful, I think, because they maybe understand where a lot of the audience is coming from in order to kind of bring them into the story.
Well, since the Pope's Exorcist kind of also had a bit of a humorous, you know, undercurrent to it, do you think that it portrays Christianity in any kind of mocking way? Would people be offended and say, oh, they're trying to really make fun of Father Gabriel?
No, I don't. I mean, I think the portrayal of the Catholic Church is highly unrealistic, and so probably any Catholic who's watching it will just roll their eyes at the all of the sort of strange and probably just ignorant ways that the Church is portrayed. But there's a lot, there's so much positive in the film, surprisingly so. The Pope is a sympathetic character who's you know working together with Amorth and is possessed by you know kind of real faith. The Pope is almost like Father Amorth's Q from James Bond, and that he's trying to kind of help him, and they're working together. And so and even the priest, the young priest that that Gabriel Amorth helps, we see him as his flawed. He's had an affair with a woman, and even sired a child as a result. But even that is portrayed fairly sympathetically. This is a fallible priest, but who still you know has a real faith. He's sinful, but he's still trying to kind of pursue this this calling. So perhaps the sympathy that the movie has with these religious characters is largely accidental, or just you know a fortunate sort of unforeseen thing. But I think that audiences of faith will find actually that here is a fairly warm, if maybe unrealistic, picture of the church.
Well, the other movie that came out earlier this spring was a film called Nefarious, and it's one of those independent Christian films. We've seen a lot of those in the theaters that really are supported by word of mouth through and marketing through actual local churches, but it didn't cost that much to make and made more than $5 million. And it definitely, as is true of some of these independent Christian films, had kind of a strong faith component to it. And as I mentioned earlier, kind of an evangelism vibe, but there were a lot of Christians that felt it would be super unedifying to see it. And of course it's streaming now. So tell us a little bit more about this particular film.
Yeah. So as you said, this is an independent kind of Christian film, as we call them. So, you know, coming out of a particular subculture of filmmaking, and it's written almost like a stage play. So it's very inexpensive film to make, largely consisting of dialogue between a psychiatrist, Dr. Martin, who goes to interview a death row inmate whose real name is Edward Wayne Brady. He's got that great serial killer middle name in there, but who also seems to be possessed or have multiple personalities, this demonic persona, and so it's their conversation as Dr. Martin has to evaluate whether or not Brady is sane in order to be executed. They're in Oklahoma, where they have the death penalty. He's to be executed by 11 at 11 p.m. that day, and so it's this dialogue basically between these two people. The atheist doctor is looking for basically natural explanations for all of this, but he's continually surprised by the strange supernatural knowledge that the demon that is possessing this inmate, they called Nefarious, seems to possess. And this demon knows about his worst sins and tells them to him, and is kind of trying to destroy his soul in some way, and kind of get hold of him. And at one point, even the psychiatrist says, you know, well, I don't even believe it. If you're really a demon, why don't you enter me? I give you permission. The demon doesn't do it then, but later he attempts to do this after the execution, by jumping into the body of Dr. Martin. But the real meat of the film, in many ways, is very much like almost like a Screwtape Letter, where we're hearing from the perspective of a demon, kind of how they do their work, what they're really aiming to do in order to win a dark battle against the enemy, using that sort of C.S. Lewis Screwtape term, the enemy being God, right? And so we have a kind of a morality play that's playing out as the demon, you know, then sort of lays out his nefarious plan for for corrupting people. He's done with the man that he had possessed, who's now going to be executed, and he wants to move on and do something, do more damage. But the at the very last moment after his execution, when he hops into the body of Dr. Martin, Dr. Martin calls for help from God, and then is delivered from the power of this demon. So it the film has a kind of a strong Christian ethos, a sort of a conversionist perspective, and then we see him kind of delivered and then now convinced of the reality of the supernatural and trying to work against the power of the devil at the end of the film.
Does this one seem nefarious? Does it seem a little bit more spooky in terms of how it's portraying the actual demon possessions? Because I think people wonder, what does that look like? And so they see the special effects and different things that are done in movies like, you know, Nefarious or The Pope's Exorcist, and expect that's what demon possession would actually be like, as to, you know, should Christians see that? And it's just this person, I don't know, the spinning heads or whatever it is. I don't know how they're actually portraying the possessions in these films.
Yeah, well, this, I don't think there's much of any gore or, you know, kind of typical horror things. It's mostly just handled through dialogue and discussion. And so people who are, you know, concerned about the, you know, the movie being, you know, overly scandalous or having a lot of content would be a little more comfortable with this, this film, I think. And so it's, again, back to Screwtape, it sort of has that Screwtape like quality of you just sort of hearing someone talk about the work of devil. And it's upsetting. It's not for kids. And so I wouldn't recommend it for those folks, but I was recommended to me initially by one of my coworkers who watched it with his wife. And said, oh, this is actually, you know, better than we expected, and had this, you know, this interesting take on a Christian film. So I think that artistically, it's a pretty uneven movie with some really nice moments in it. A fabulous performance at the center of it by Hollywood actor Sean Patrick Flannery, who plays the inmate with the multiple personality / demon possession. He's in Boondock Saints, people who know that movie, and it's been a number of things. He's really excellent, and whenever he's talking, it's incredibly compelling. And so I think it's an interesting film to as an entry into the exorcism genre. It's fascinating to watch Christian independent cinema to take on horror elements, you know, which is a little bit unusual, and normally you get uplifting and inspirational films. This movie is uplifting in the end. But it's definitely a fascinating entry into possession filmmaking.
Well, earlier I mentioned the OG exorcism movie, which is The Exorcist from 1973, and that was based on a horror novel by William Peter Blatty, and he was a Roman Catholic too, and it was directed by William Friedkin, which you said he also did a documentary on Father Gabriel, so that's interesting. And so it was a box office hit for the time, and it's considered just like one of those, you know, classic films that you need to watch in your history of cinema type of classes. So how was this particular film, The Exorcist, how is it really kind of the foundation that everyone goes to? Okay, this is the one, that this is the template that other horror films need to follow.
Yeah, so I mean, The Exorcist is that's Mount Olympus. That's the high watermark for exorcism films, and it's really never been beat. It's really kind of the first to establish the genre, and really does everything just about the best that you can do. As you look back, of course, now some of the effects seem a bit old. People have described it as one of the scariest movies ever made, and it's incredibly effective. I think there are kind of two ways that the film establishes the template. I mean, one is, of course, that it's really focused on the struggle between good and evil, focused around the exorcism process. And it's a prolonged process. Basically, the last act of the movie is this this long battle between these priests and this demon that's inhabiting this young girl. And the demon is doing everything possible to kind of profane the image of God in this young girl. And then the director's cut, you know, we hear the one of the priests, the senior exorcist, to kind of describe why they're doing it. This demon is doing it to make us believe that God could never love us, right? Do it to kind of to make it seem as if, you know, kind of humans are unworthy of love. And against this, continually and sort of painfully and patiently, the priests have to kind of say the truth that they know about the power of God and say these prayers. And the exorcist then adds, as it were, this additional dramatic element that we see also in the Pope's Exorcist, which is that at the very end of the film, the only priest standing, one of the priests dies in the process, and the other priest finally tells the demon to come into him and to possess him. And the demon leaps from the little girl into him, and then he's about to turn and strangle the girl and kind of complete this this profane destruction of the image of God. But the priest summons some will and throws himself out a window and dies while receiving last rites from another priest. There's this self-sacrificial element within the story that's not part of standard exorcism practice, right? That's not what you're supposed to do. It's kind of an additional twist for added punch. And the Pope's Exorcist deals this as well. This is what Father Amorth does as well. He managed to fight off the demon and recover. So you have this dramatic exorcism at the center of things that defines the story. But then the other thematic element that is so prevalent in exorcism movies is that it's not just a struggle between good and evil, between God and the devil, but there's also a struggle between faith and doubt. And so exorcism movies are very much modern films. They're the movies that we have, and the exorcist, the one that establishes this, is that part of the struggle is the struggle to really believe kind of all the aspects of a biblical thought world. And so when the mother of this possessed girl and the exorcist comes to the priest at first, she says, "I think I need an exorcist." He says, "Well, you're going to need to get a time machine. We don't do that anymore." But he's wrong, because there are still people who are steeped in this old practice, and that provide the only possible deliverance for this girl. She's been to all the doctors, all the psychiatrists, nothing can help except the power of God. And so in that way, almost all of these movies, you know, really kind of question the reality of the devil, the kind of necessity of exorcism, whether this is a valid form of treatment for anyone. And so they wrestle with these faith questions while they're also wrestling with the demonic.
The other exorcism film that I want to ask you about is one that came out back in 2005 from a Biola Christian University graduate who was the director of this film, and that would be Scott Derrickson, and he made a film called The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And of course, once again, we're talking about the Roman Catholic Church and a priest involved in that particular film, in the character, a character. And it wasn't made for that much, but it made over $100 million at the box office. And then he was tapped later on to go direct a Marvel movie, which is pretty amazing. So what does that particular entry bring to the exorcism genre? And actually, there are some big name, you know, Hollywood stars in it. Laura Linney, she's just a well-known character actor. Same with Tom Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm. I would say that is, if people are looking for a movie that is really participates in the exorcism genre, but then also has, I think, a kind of a positive faith perspective, and also is a little bit more of something you're just kind of putting your toe into, The Exorcism of Emily Rose is probably about the best that you're going to do. It's a PG-13 movie. It's still scary and works well as an entry into the horror genre, but it exactly struggles with this this question that I was just describing between faith and doubt. And so what we have is we have a priest, Father Moore, who's on trial because he attempted an exorcism of this 19-year-old college student, whose name is Emily, and in the process, the exorcism fails, and the girl dies, or the exorcism works, and she still dies. And so he's put on trial because there's a question that the courts have, which is, you know, is this a legitimate treatment for anyone, right? She's dealing with all these problems. You know, is exorcism ever the solution to your problems? And so what you have is we have the Father Moore's defender is a woman who's skeptical, played by Laura Linney. And his prosecutor is a man who actually believes in God, but he's basically arguing, you know, demon possession is not real. Exorcism is not a valid cure for her ills. And so, as it were, the question of the reality of the spiritual itself is put on trial, right? Whether or not exorcism is legitimate just naturally raises this question. Like, are there such things as demons? And so the trial goes on. And in the film, what's interesting is that not only are we recounted the story of Emily and how she came to be possessed while she was off at college, but we also see that the demonic seems to be kind of pervading the world of the trial. So Laura Linney's character is all these spooky things begin to happen to her. And when she lies down at night and goes to sleep, we see her alarm clock, her digital alarm clock, the numbers get all crazy and begin to move around in strange ways. And so the film itself suggests, of course, that there is a supernatural realm and that we're just oblivious to it. We oughtn't be. And then as the film concludes, we go back and we see Laura Linney's character lay down in bed and she looks at her alarm clock and enough strange things happen. You see her turn the alarm clock around to the wall because she's no longer so sturdy in her skepticism. And the genius thing about the film produced by Scott Derrickson, who comes from a position of faith, is that then the audience, as they leave the theater, maybe in the at night, and go home having watched the scary movie, they lay down in their bed. The last thing they see before they go to sleep is their alarm clock right there, right? And so the film is, as it were, kind of pushing us perhaps to see the world as being filled with more things than we had previously imagined or considered.
It's really interesting because just the whole idea of the horror genre is something I don't think Christians could see as something that would be used in a way that they could interact with unbelievers about, you know, in terms of a springboard for apologetics. And that they probably haven't given much consideration as to why people, even including, as we talked about earlier, people who aren't religious, people who are not Christians, are interested in horror and this genre of exorcism. And so I want to ask you about the philosopher Charles Taylor. I know you're quoting him in your article, and he talks about a reason why he thinks that audiences are interested in stories about demons. And he talks about there's been a shift from the Middle Ages to now, and it kind of explains a little bit about why all kinds of people are interested in horror movies. So what does Taylor say about this?
Yeah, so Charles Taylor's a Canadian philosopher, and he has a big book called The Secular Age that talks about kind of how we got where we are now and some of the big changes that have happened in the West, or what he calls North Atlantic culture, that separate us from our medieval ancestors, for instance. And there are lots of things that have changed about our kind of default perspective, you might just say our default worldview. And one of those shifts is that we've moved from what Taylor calls a kind of a porous self to a buffered self. And the porous self is views the kind of human person as being profoundly open to forces that could act upon it or affect our mood and influence us in certain ways. So maybe the planets and their movement, their characters might have influence on us, or holy objects, or evil and cursed objects might influence us in certain ways. And likewise, the spiritual world can kind of pervade us like we're like water soaking easily into a sponge, where the old view of the old human person has now shifted so that now, following modernity, we're much more likely to see us as kind of buffered, right? We're boundaried, and so what's really truly us is what happens inside our heads. You might think, kind of following Descartes, you know, and this shift to the rationalistic kind of view of a human person as a thinking thing. And so he really sees now that we're kind of, if we see ourselves as influenced, maybe I'm influenced by thoughts that I'm having or bad food that I ate or my own brain chemistry, but not spiritual forces that are around us. So Taylor says, you know, really, if there's a reason why people are interested in horror movies now, it's because we've lost this sense of vulnerability to the spiritual, right? And maybe we just look back and with nostalgia at kind of an old way of being. This is where our ancestors would have thought it was crazy to expose yourself to such stories. And I think that Taylor's makes an interesting point, and one that I half agree with, which is that there's a sense in which I think we are interested in these movies because they help us to recognize something that we've lost, right? And sort of see spiritual possibilities that are no longer kind of part of our everyday reality. And so I think we're doing it more than just to experience a kind of a little frisson of excitement. That's what Taylor kind of thinks. I think that we're actually hungry for a deeper sense of the sort of spiritual world that does surround and pervade everything we do, even if we've forgotten about it.
Well, on a much lighter note and hopefully not scary, I have a fun question for Phil. Phil, it's summer. So as far as summer desserts are concerned, are you team ice cream or team s'mores?
Oh, yeah, ice cream all the way. I'm not that big a s'more fan, honestly. So I'd always rather have ice cream. And I live in Houston. Who's having a fire these days? That's crazy.
That's true. I don't know that you're having many campfires down in Houston. Well, Phil, thanks for being a guest again for the 350th episode and being there with us at the very beginning. And it was great to talk to you.
Absolutely. I'm look forward to being back for episode 400.
You've been listening to episode 350 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Philip Tallon. He has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called The Power of the Devil Compels Us, Possession and Exorcism Movies in a Modern Age. And you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.